T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Hey, it's Sunday Take. This is Blois. It's March 6th, 2022. We're about 246 days from Election Day. This week, the state reported its largest budget surplus ever. And we have a very competitive race growing in the first congressional district since Representative Jim Hagedorn passed away. But there doesn't seem to be any urgency around some of the bigger issues of the day, whether it's public safety, education, taxes that we talked about last week. There just doesn't seem to be a lot of urgency. Is that just the Minnesota passive aggressive way being amplified at the legislature? Or is it because political leaders have a tough time with big decisions these days? One of the things that strikes me is even after the legislature passes things, there's a runway before anything gets enacted. And on urgent issues from housing to crime and public safety, there's urgency. We'll try to figure out that urgency this week. We'll talk to Jeremy Munson, who's going to run in the first congressional district. We'll talk to Public Safety Commissioner John Harrington about the whole picture on public safety and why some of these violent gun cases just don't seem to make sense to the public. And then we'll end the conversation with Representative Ilhan Omar on the way she views the way forward for Democrats, with Joe Biden being unpopular and the far left being one of the reasons why. I'm Blois Olson. This is Sunday Take on News Talk 830 WCCO.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
This week's first interview on Sunday Take is with Representative Jeremy Munson. He's a state representative, and he's said and planning to announce that he's running for Congress in the next few days. He's waited, like many, for the services of the late Jim Hagedorn to pass. And he joins me this morning to talk about why he would give up a seat in the state house to run for Congress. Representative Munson, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me on, Blois.
So obviously, you know, in the last few weeks, we've all reflected on Representative Hagedorn's legacy and career. What would you say about his legacy or career that you want to move forward as you embark on a race to run for Congress?
Well, Jim was a great friend and mentor to me and to many others in the district. And his life was based in service. He wanted to serve in Congress like his father. And look, I got to say, he's been my conservative voice in D.C. He's had impressive votes, and voted even against Trump's big budget that most Republicans voted for. And he said he was going to vote against some of these bills like that, and he went out to D.C. and he did. He was a good conservative and a fiscal conservative. And everybody is thankful for his service.
So you talk about the fiscal conservatism. Is that the number one or number two issue that conservatives are most concerned about? Because it feels like, through headlines, and you'll see this and we'll cover it through the congressional race, that there's so many kind of, I'll call them shiny object issues that the media gets caught up in. But what are the core issues that you want to, represent if you're successful in this race for Minnesota's first district in Washington?
Well, serving in the state legislature has given me a lot of knowledge on the separation between state and federal issues. And, I went to St. Paul to work on lowering the cost of healthcare. And when you get to the end of what you're trying to work on, so many of the reasons why we have things at the state level is because the federal government has required things of us. And so working on, healthcare costs at the federal level will be something that I will spend time doing. But, right out of the gate, obviously, we have some federal issues on immigration reform that we need to work on. We need energy independence back. That has really been highlighted with what's happening in the Ukraine, on how important it is to be energy independent, to not be buying oil from Russia and countries that don't like us, and working on foreign policy issues, and making sure that the federal government doesn't change election law for the states. And so it's going to be different serving in the majority in Congress versus right now. We know they're in the minority, and it's very difficult you can vote against the spending bills, but you can vote against most everything that the Democrats are putting forward in the House. But focusing on the priorities for the district and agriculture, small businesses, ensuring we protect private health care and private insurance options is important.
While serving in St. Paul, you and others started a separate caucus from I'll call it the traditional Republican caucus. Seen as kind of a rogue move. Describe how you made that decision, why you made that decision, and if you think that those are the kinds of things that in D.C. could happen, knowing that there's even division within Republicans in D.C. amongst, leadership and newer members.
Well, the reason why I'll explain the history of the Newhouse caucus. It was really founded in the need to hire staff that works for the district. In St. Paul, all of the staff allocation, each member gets, let's say, one full-time employee. That allocation is given to the leadership, and then they determine how those people are going to work. And the new members to the House usually get the staff that's not as effective. They haven't been there long, or they've never had a job before in politics. And so we wanted staff that would actually be knowledgeable to help us advance our legislation, to message when we wanted to vote against even Republican bills. And so we made the decision to hire staff directly like they used to in the House and Senate. And it was for that reason that, the leader at the time, Kurt Dowd, said that we couldn't caucus with them. We didn't have a desire to caucus separately. We just wanted to hire our own staff. But there was a division there, because they didn't like that we hired our own staff. I'm going to be on the Republican team. We're the Newhouse Republican caucus is very much Republican, and certainly have support among the grassroots. And when I go to Washington, I'm going to be on the team.
My guest is Representative Jeremy Munson. He's a state representative. He's announcing this week he's going to run for Jim Hagedorn's open seat in the first congressional district. Representative Munson, there's expected to be others running for this seat. What's going to differentiate you? And have you spoken to Jennifer Carnahan about whether or not she's going to run? Any thoughts on that? And would that change your decision at all?
Well, there will be likely, you know, many candidates that jump into this race, given the short timeline. What differentiates me is that that I have a proven track record of voting conservatively, working on issues that are important for the district, being effective to get things done. There are several people who are interested in running who served 15 years ago. And the country is, I mean, the country has changed drastically in the last few years. The political environment has changed. And, you know, I've been in the trenches with the grassroots fighting against the lockdowns and you know, pushing back on executive overreach, filing lawsuits against the Secretary of State and Governor Walz for doing things that have been proven by the courts to be unconstitutional. And so I've been with him on these issues. And I think that that has built up name recognition in the district. People have, they trust that I'm going to fight for them. As far as Jennifer Carnahan, I don't know if she's going to run or not. Being a spouse of Congressman Hagedorn does not entitle her to have the seat. I did speak with her at Jim's service, and we didn't talk politics. That wasn't an appropriate time.
Representative Munson's my guest. And, you know, last question here, you talked about, you know, pushing back against Walz mandates. You talked about lawsuits. You know, one issue that kind of comes to mind whenever I think of you is that you float an idea that certain counties from Minnesota should secede. I think it got a lot of headlines. I don't think there was a lot of, you know, opportunity for it to ever be a reality. But when you look at Congress, and this week, this past week, the State of the Union, members who heckled the president during the State of the Union, things like that, there's a certain decorum that I think people expect from elected officials, even in Congress. Is it about the serious work, or is it about kind of throwing ideas out there for, you know, everybody to kind of chew on, or for the headline, or for the politics to drum up the base? Do you look at it differently if you're running for Congress versus the State House?
The bill that would allow the bill that created the bill that would create a path for counties to secede to neighboring states was the beginning of an important conversation to highlight the discrepancy between the taxes and regulatory structure of Minnesota compared to neighboring states. We have people in Minnesota that are in my community that are moving to Sioux Falls. And the request from constituents was, why can't we stay in our own community and just choose different governance, choose different, you know, why can't we have the taxes that South Dakota and the regulations that South Dakota or Iowa have? And that was the purpose of introducing that bill, to start the conversation. And it did spark an important conversation, got national attention. And I was able to go out and talk about why people are moving from Minnesota to neighboring states and why Minnesotans are at a competitive disadvantage to their neighbors, right? It wasn't like creating a whole new state, but it did start the conversation. And sometimes, especially in the minority, when you want to have that important conversation, you need to take a playbook, you know, something out of the playbook from Trump, which is to make a statement that's bold, that attracts attention, in order for you to have an important conversation so people pay attention. And that's what that bill was about.
You bring up President Trump, and as we close here, obviously that's going to be part of the spirit of this race in the first district. The first district has an independent streak. You know, Representative Hagedorn won with comfortable margin last time, but, you know, it was represented by Governor Walz before that. Is it about Jeremy Munson, or is it about a movement of Trump Republicans to try to keep this seat? And because, again, it's about the whole district, not just, you know, kind of the Republican constituency once you get to Congress.
Sure. I mean, I think this race is going to be a referendum on Biden, in a referendum on the extremist policies that are being pushed in Washington, D.C., and the need to take back the majority or to retain this seat so that we can have the majority in D.C. Trump was a populist president, and I also will run on some issues that are populist issues. But it is not going to be an election on Trump versus Biden. It's going to be a referendum pushing back on the bad policies of Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden.
Representative Jeremy Munson, thanks for joining me on Sunday Take. When we come back, Commissioner John Harrington, he's going to talk about why we keep hearing stories that just don't make sense when it comes to public safety and criminal justice. I'm Blois Olson. You're listening to Sunday Take on News Talk 830 WCCO. We're back on Sunday Take. Joining me now is Public Safety Commissioner John Harrington. He's been a legislator. He's been an officer of the law. He's been a police chief. Now he sits at the helm of Minnesota's public safety system. He's been at the forefront. He's been with the governor. He's been in a series of listening sessions the last couple of weeks. And I wanted to kind of just dig down a little deeper onto where on the spectrum of public safety, where we need some solutions immediately, why some of the system is working one way that makes people scratch their heads sometimes. So, Commissioner, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Blois, it's a pleasure to see you again. You're a man of many hats.
Thanks, Commissioner.
You described my mini hats, but I think we could spend as much time talking about your mini hats also. But we'll dive in here pretty quickly. I know you only have a little bit of time.
We know that we've known each other a long time, and we've worn different hats with each other through those years. Overall, right now, public safety is a talking issue. It's a talker. Wherever I go, whatever I do, it's one of the things my neighbors bring up. People bring it up at the hockey rink, at the local establishment. You look at Minneapolis as one area. You look at the suburbs. But this is a statewide issue. Explain how you look at it as a commissioner, as a statewide issue, because the issues aren't just confined to the Twin Cities.
No, it's definitely not confined to the Twin Cities, although we started doing some preliminary work. Thankfully, Drew Evans and the BCA has shifted from UCR data to NIBRS. And so we're able to get a little bit more information a little quicker than we used to. And we're starting to track the 7-county metro area has definitely seen a spike. The Twin Cities, no secret there. St. Paul went past its record of homicides. Minneapolis tied its records of homicides. The state has seen, I think, 100 more fatal crashes in the last year. And overlaying all of that is a topic that you can't quantify as easily, but I think it's what is driving the conversation, which is fear. And I started out as a community policing cop, a beat cop, back when responding to fear in the community was one of the things that police departments were recognizing they needed to do. But just the data, I will say, points me to say that, that this is not as simplistic as it's just a Minneapolis or just a St. Paul problem. It's in some regards, it's very similar to the aha moment I had when Attorney General Ellison and I did the deadly forest encounters working group, where we discovered that 60% of the deadly forest encounters were in greater Minnesota, not in the Twin Cities, which is, I think, counter to what the public narrative was at the time, which everybody assumed that was a Minneapolis or a St. Paul issue, and it's not. So we're seeing this level of criminality across the state, but it's more episodic. It's more concentrated right now in the Twin Cities area. And we're recognizing that, which is why you saw Minnesota State Patrol do heat in yep. the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. It's why you may have heard the aviation unit from the State Patrol hovering over Minneapolis on a yep. number of occasions as we tried to work on the carjacking issues. It's why I have extra BCA agents investigating gun crimes in Minneapolis, and why we're having conversations regularly with the first ring suburbs, the Twin Cities, and the sheriffs around there to say, what are we going to do as we get ready for the spring? Because we know that the spring will come. And unfortunately, we recognize that that historically has been when we see an uptick in crime. We haven't seen that crime flatten out this year the way we had in the past. So we really do have to get about our business.
Well, I think you acknowledging just the spike is the first step, because, so much of this debate has been driven by those with the loudest voices on any side rather than those who are actually having the conversations every day. One of the topics that comes up is there'll be someone, they allegedly commit a crime, but there's pretty good evidence that they committed this crime. There was one this week where in Brooklyn Park, somebody shot up a townhouse complex, including shooting their neighbor. led police on a chase and then hit two police cars and then got out on bail. I know you can't talk about the specifics of that case or any case, but can you kind of talk about how the system is so that everyday Minnesotans go, why does that person get out on bail, or why isn't that person held longer? You know, kind of this old mentality of, well, let's throw the book at them. I think everybody understands you're innocent until proven guilty, but there just seems to be story after story about people getting out before maybe common sense says they should get out if they're a violent, you know, repeat offender.
Well, and I think two parts to that conversation that we're watching and that we're engaged in the conversation. One of is about the whole conversation about cash bail. And there has been a conversation at the policy and the legislative level, not just here in Minnesota, but this is a national conversation. Yep. About cash bail, and does cash bail put someone's thumb on the scale to allow a racially disparate impact on crime? And whether you believe that or not, there are funds that have been created to, I think their original intent may well have been to level that out. Unfortunately, one of the things we see, and I see it probably on Twitter as you do in some cases,
yeah,
is when folks that are committing criminal acts in the Black community, in the Latino community, in the Asian community, get out on bail based on that system. I've got members of that community, the Black community, the Asian community, the Latino community, the church community, asking me the question, why did they get out? Because we're the victims, and nobody, yeah, seems to have been asking them, you know, the Bishop Smiths and the Bishop Howells and the Ronnie Pattersons of the world. They're not asking them, is this good for the east side of St. Paul or the Midway District or Brooklyn Park or North Minneapolis? And I think that's where this disconnect is partly coming from, is you identified it, that there's groups of people who have very loud voices who are stating their truth, but their truth may not be the truth,
right,
for the folks that live in that townhouse complex who had to come back the next day and think about, well, somebody who shot the place up may be coming home, and are they in a better state of mind? Are they not likely to do this again? And there are some real challenges in trying to address what I would see as problem person behavior. And by that, I mean very specifically repeat criminal behavior.
Yep.
Folks that have a history and a pattern of, whether it's domestic violence, gun violence, the carjackings, where we're seeing some of those cases are not isolated. They may be looked at as isolated by one county attorney or another, but in fact, our boundary lines on a nice map are not necessarily respected or viewed as important by some of the criminal element that we end up having to interact with.
No, I think that makes sense. My guest is Commissioner John Harrington. He's the Commissioner of Public Safety for the state. He's also been a state senator, a beat cop, a police chief. So I know you and Governor Walz have been, and others have been holding some roundtables. I also know you interface with the legislature on a bipartisan basis. Republicans have some ideas. The governor has some ideas. DFLers have some other ideas. From where you sit, are there some things we can do quickly in the near term, A, to help with this summer, either funding-wise, program-wise, penalty-wise? And are there some things we need to do for the long term so that, you know, we can kind of reverse this trend?
Well, we have pitched an idea that we refer to as prevention, intervention, and targeted enforcement. And that seems to have some support. I've heard Governor Walz has very definitely added it in his budget. I've heard conversations I've had with Democratic and Republican legislators who recognize that providing funding to the community so that they can start right now.
Yep.
And I mean, literally right now, getting out there to take the prevention activities that we need is an important first step, because frankly, while I am absolutely 100% in favor of all the recruiting efforts that we can possibly do, we absolutely need more cops. We need more social workers. We need more of a lot of things right now. That lag in time from the time that we start recruiting to when they're actually on the streets won't get me anywhere for this summer. And so what I'm really banking on is that I can get groups like 21 Days of Peace, Bishop Howell's group that went out and stood at Broadway and Lyndale,
yep,
a corner, and dropped the crime rate there. Nothing else really changed there. There weren't more cops. There weren't more of anything else. Aside from the church ladies and fathers there, it dropped it by, I think what Charlie Adams told me, by 45%.
Wow.
That's a huge difference. Bishop Smith is over in Brooklyn Park, has talked about the success he's had of getting young men who were standing on the corners, probably selling dope at one point or another,
yep,
getting employed and working with him, and the drop off in their criminal behavior and the amount of crime around those corners once he did that. So prevention, I think, is really the smart play. It's the fastest play we can do. We also do have to think about intervention, though. There are folks out there that we really do need to think about. And that really speaks to sort of a more medium-term process. Mental health, we don't have nearly enough mental health beds. If you've got
right,
a kid who has a mental health crisis right now, they'll sit in an emergency room for days waiting for a bed and for good therapy. If you have a kid who is addicted to meth, or heroin or one of the opiates, we're seeing fentanyl come in quantities that would kill thousands and thousands of people. We need to have a healthcare model that we can intervene in those young people's lives and get them on the right track. And then the last piece, and this is one that we're working a lot on right now, working with Minneapolis and St. Paul and working with the BCA. How do we identify the most dangerous folks out there, the folks that, you know, the folks that are the shooters, the ones that are out there doing the carjackings, that are doing, yep, multiple crimes with violence, because those folks we need to target. We need to have a focused, intentional effort to incapacitate their ability to commit further crimes. And that really does mean doing it the way community policing was based on. That would mean having the county attorney, the U.S. attorney, the BCA, the local police, the local county sheriff,
mm-hmm,
all together to help identify, this is what we're going to go after. We're going to go after gun violence this summer. We're going to go after the people, yep, that are shooting other people. And when we get the people that we know are doing that, there's an agreement across the board that says, we will go after them. We will investigate them. We will bring good cases to. And when we bring those good cases, you will hold them, you will hard charge them, and you will go aggressively to try and make sure that they are incapacitated from being able to do that again. Because I think that sends a message to the other ones that are watching.
Yeah.
That says, no, you're not just going to do this and get away with it. You know, I was really gratified to see BCA get the arrest on one of the kids that got killed over in North Minneapolis. It took hundreds of search warrants to do that. That was targeted enforcement. We were very, right, deliberate about, we were going to focus on those babies killers and we were going to bring them to justice. And we want the others that have shot the babies out there, we're coming for you.
Yep.
That is a promise that we're never going to give up trying to find you and bring you to justice. And when we do, I expect that the U.S. attorney and the county attorney and others will be there with us to hold them accountable.
As we wrap this conversation, one thing that kind of, from what you say, is this targeted go after the repeat violent offenders, carjackers, gun crimes this summer, coordinated effort, federal, local, state. Then you go to the prosecutors. I know you're a legislator. You talk to legislators, probably Republicans, who have this mantra of we have to incarcerate them longer. We have to make sure they don't get out on bail, those kinds of things. I also know that you talk to sheriffs who need tools. And then obviously there's likely some deep intelligence on the court system. What is it that brings those things together to get us in a different direction, especially on the violent offenders getting charged with the right crimes? Is it that maybe we need federal prosecutors to take some of these cases because they either have more resources or tougher penalties, or is it prosecutors locally getting better evidence or better investigations from local law enforcement? Is there any trend there that you think in the final parts of this conversation that both Republicans and Democrats go, yeah, that will help if we pass a new law or if we enact laws we have in a different way?
I don't know that we need new laws. I'll be perfectly frank. I don't know that a 13 or 14 year old who goes out and carjacks somebody or takes a shot at somebody is thinking about how many years in prison they're
right,
likely to do. I don't, yeah, know that is part of their mindset. I also don't know that deterrence is not involved. But I harken back to Minnesota Heels and to a program we ran over in St. Paul called SAGA, Stop Armed Gang Assaults, where we worked with the U.S. attorney and with the county attorneys. And we very much articulated that we were going to go after the gangs who were committing the crimes in Phillips back in Minnesota Heels days. And the gangs that were doing it, killing each other on the St. Paul side during my tenure there. I really do think what brought that together, though, was leadership from the prosecutor's office. We drove it from the police department because we were hearing directly from the community. We were hearing from the victims. We were hearing from the moms. We were hearing from the pastors who reminded me that you think it's tough going to those crime scenes, Chief? I'm the one that buries those kids.
Yeah.
You know, you think about Bishop Hall, how many awful funerals he's had at his church. Ronnie Patterson over in New Hope Baptist, same thing. So when we listen to the community and let the community voices drive where we go, it was easier to bring the county attorney, to bring the U.S. attorney, to bring the variety of different state and local agencies together to say, we're going to focus. And I think that's what requires right now. We are being pulled in a lot of different directions right now. And I think what we really need right now is to focus on the most serious crimes, the most repeat offenders, and then focus on the victims. That would be, but my last piece of this is, I don't think we pay nearly enough attention to the victims of crime, the families that are left behind. I think that is, if we listen to their voices, I think you would have a very clear direction as to what they would like to see us do.
Commissioner John Harrington, thanks for joining me on Sunday Take.
Always a pleasure.
When we come back, Representative Ilhan Omar, where is DC headed and how does she feel about President Biden's job approval today? I'm Blaise Olson. This is Sunday Take. Joining me for the final conversation this Sunday morning is Representative Ilhan Omar, and I want to welcome her for the first time on the Sunday Take. And earlier this week, President Biden gave the State of the Union, gave a broad agenda, and I haven't seen much about her thoughts on the speech. And so I'll just start there, Representative Omar. Welcome to the show. Your thoughts on President Biden's State of the Union this week?
Yeah, well, glad to be here. I didn't know it was my first time. I thought I've been on before. I thought the president did an excellent job with the speech. It was short. It was sweet. It hit all the marks. I think it was probably one of the most bipartisan State of the Union addresses where people on both sides of the aisle were routinely getting up to clap for the president. I don't think we've seen that in a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was excellent.
One of the challenges for President Biden has been moving through some of the bigger agenda items, specifically Build Back Better. Is there anything on the horizon that you think the president, Democrats can get through, or where the priorities still lie after this 2-year kind of COVID, this is what we need, fire hose of policies and spending? What's in the near term that you think should be a priority after Build Back Better didn't make it through?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I thought he did an excellent job with was both talking about, you know, some of those fire hose issues that, you know, that are needed to be addressed, that are a response, whether it's Ukraine, whether it is trying to get more money for COVID relief and, you know, working to get people back to work, addressing the inflation and some of the energy costs and all kinds of things that people really need an immediate response to. And then he also, you know, named Build Back Better and said, you know, this is the kind of investment we need to actually create once in a generational investment. And I think he's still committed to that. I think it will be smaller and will probably not have all of the things the last one had. And I think everyone's probably going to be a little bit more disciplined in being, you know, in having a realistic expectation of what could be agreed upon, and getting that done. So I do think that there is an opportunity for us to pass something. It won't be as cumbersome as the last attempt was, but it will still be a really impactful package.
You brought up inflation. It's impacting everybody. No matter what your party is, inflation isn't impacting you. President Biden's approval, historic midterms. Where do you see the opportunities for Democrats to try to kind of fight against these political headwinds as we go into the election season? Representing, you know, the more progressive part of the Democratic Party, you know, internally, some people think that's one of the challenges. I know progressives often think, no, if we stuck to that and didn't moderate, we'd be better off. Where do you think the opportunities are for either President Biden or congressional Democrats to find some momentum here before November?
I mean, the opportunities, I think, already exist. We just need to seize them, right? There's a lot of good things that we have accomplished. Our country is at a different point than it was, you know, a little over a year ago. And we're just not seizing the opportunity to talk about the investments that we've made in the American Rescue Plan, which is something that I've done with the First Lady, Dr. Jill Biden, in bringing her to Minnesota to highlight some of the investments from that bill that we made in childcare and getting some of the childcare centers back and operational. And so I think that, you know, as we continue to push for more investments and that big agenda of building our country back better, we also have to celebrate some of the investments that we've made that many people still haven't felt or noticed or haven't heard us talk about. I think, you know, when we were in Minnesota with the First Lady and at the University of Minnesota to talk about these investments, I think, you know, some of the families that we were chatting with knew they got this help. A lot of the centers knew they got this help, but I don't think they made the connection that the help came from this particularly large package of funding that was passed after the president was sworn in. And so we just have to make the connection for people that these investments that they're feeling in their day-to-day lives are investments that were possible because Democrats control both the House, the Senate, and the White House. And if you continue to keep us there and send us more people, we will continue to make bigger investments in your lives.
No, there's no doubt that childcare is one of those issues that I think is impacting people at levels we haven't seen before. I talked about it earlier this week. One of the other things of this election year is Governor Walz is on the ballot. You were vocal in some of your criticism of Governor Walz in the past. Are you going to support him for governor? Do you think he needs to address any new issues before you support him? Where do you stand on kind of the state of politics in Minnesota right now?
The governor, I you know, and I agree on more things than we don't. We obviously need his leadership in our state. And I do believe that him and our lieutenant governor need to keep their seat. And we are going to do everything that we can to make sure that we are organizing our congressional district so that they have a successful reelection.
Got it. Representative Ilhan Omar is my guest. Final question. You have some challengers. What do you feel about, you know, the challenges from multiple Republicans and then maybe potential challenges from Democrats in this, you know, we're about 243 days away from a kind of a volatile election. What are you hearing, you know, from your constituents about what's important that gets addressed in the near term, maybe related to public safety or the inflation and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, many of my constituents, as you and I have talked about quite often, you know, they're the top three issues that, you know, every time that we do our survey, our climate, housing and climate, housing and educational investment. And
okay.
Those are the issues we prioritize. And in, you know, in regards to elections, I always say you get what you organize for. And so we intend to organize our district for victory, whether it is a primary or a general, like we always have.
Representative Ilhan Omar, thanks for joining me on Sunday Take.
Thank you.
When it's Sunday at 9 on WCCO, it's Sunday Take. I'm Blois Olson.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL Draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.